Hello, I'm Dr. Conan Tu. Thank you for joining us for the glow-up era of MASH management. This initiative is sponsored by an educational grant from Novo Nordisk Incorporated. You will notice the asterisk there because we need to define glow-up for older physicians like myself who really are not up to date with the lingo. So in modern slang, glow-up means dramatic positive change, and we are here to change your knowledge about MASH management. So, this is the first of four CMEO snacks in the series. Today's episode will address screening and risk stratification for MASLD and MASH. Again, I'm Conan Tu. I'm the Regional Chief of Primary Care for Optum, New York, New Jersey. I am an adult internal medicine physician by training, and I am also board certified in diabetology. I'm located in Bethpage, New York. And I'm very pleased to be joined today by my esteemed colleague, Dr. Arun Jasudian, who I will ask to introduce himself. Welcome, Dr. Jasudian.
Thank you very much, Dr. Tu. I am happy to be here. I'm Dr. Arun Jasudian. I'm a professor of clinical medicine and director of liver quality and inpatient liver services at New York Presbyterian Hospital and Weill Cornell Medicine in New York City.
Awesome. So, I mean, your perspective and my perspective are slightly different. I'm more on the primary care and diabetes side, and you are more on the specialty side. So, we're going to get a really great viewpoint from yourself and myself on the different aspects of MASLD and MASH management as the patient goes through the diagnostic and treatment pathway. So, thank you very much for joining me. We're looking really forward to our discussion. Here is our learning objective for today's program. After participating in this activity, learners should be better able to identify best practices for optimal screening, identification, and risk stratification of patients at high risk for MASH with fibrosis. To set the stage for our discussion, let's start with a few fundamental definitions. Dr. Jasudian, would you please do the honors?
Yes, happy to. So let's start by defining what MASLD and MASH are. So MASLD is metabolic dysfunction-associated steatotic liver disease, what we used to call non-alcoholic fatty liver disease. This is new nomenclature that really focuses on the steatosis, the fat in the liver. And this is defined by a patient who has fat in their liver, steatosis in greater than or equal to 5% of their hepatocytes, their liver cells. Importantly, MASLD does not really involve significant alcohol consumption. So these are patients who have minimal alcohol consumption, and also they do not have other etiologies of liver disease and specifically of liver steatosis. And some of those that you might need to exclude are things like medications that cause steatosis in the liver. So, for example, steroids or tamoxifen, HIV, lipodystrophy. MASLD is extremely common. So, fat in the liver in the absence of alcohol or secondary causes is prevalent in about 30% of adults worldwide. And that prevalence is expected to increase as we see more and more obesity and type 2 diabetes and metabolic syndrome in general. Now, when there is inflammation and liver cell damage in addition to the fat, that's when a patient has gone on to develop MASH or metabolic dysfunction associated steatohepatitis. This is important because these patients can progress and develop fibrosis or scarring of their liver. Ultimately, they could develop the final stage of scarring of their liver, cirrhosis, and be at risk of major liver-related outcomes like decompensated cirrhosis, requiring a transplant, or developing liver cancer, hepatocellular carcinoma. It's important to appreciate that MASLD is often asymptomatic and often discovered incidentally during routine labs in patients at risk. So those patients with metabolic syndrome would be a good example of who's at risk. Now, to round out our discussion, there are a couple other types of steatotic liver disease that's worth mentioning. So patients are allowed to drink more alcohol than a minimal amount, but also have metabolic syndrome and MASLD type features. If you have the combination of those two, this is when you can diagnose a patient with MALD, or metabolic dysfunction and alcohol-associated liver disease. These are patients who have hepatic steatosis. They have at least one metabolic risk factor and moderate alcohol consumption. And we often talk about alcohol consumption in terms of grams of alcohol per day. So this could be 20 to 50 grams a day for a female, or 30 to 60 grams a day for a man. And this results from a combination of metabolic dysfunction and this moderate alcohol consumption. So this represents a spectrum between MASLD predominant and alcohol predominant disease. Now, certain patients have really alcohol-associated liver disease, or ALD. These are patients who are drinking heavily, greater than 50 grams of alcohol a day for women, or 60 grams a day for men. And remember, a standard drink contains about 14 grams of alcohol. So that's how you can figure out how many units that is for your patients. But these are patients, alcohol-associated liver disease, who really don't have much of the metabolic syndrome at play. Their steatotic liver disease is the consequence of their heavy alcohol consumption.
Gotcha. Thank you very much, Dr. Chasudian. In my practice as a primary care physician and also a diabetologist taking care of patients with prediabetes and diabetes, I've been following the guidelines and starting to screen my patients a little bit more, and I am absolutely shocked with the incidence of MASLD and MASH in my patients. I wanted to share a little bit about guidelines that I use for screening patients, those that are at risk that we should really be applying the new MASLD and MASH screening guidelines to. And let's go over the AASLD, that's the American Association for Steatotic Liver Disease guidelines, about the risk factors and things that we should be really looking at for our patients, and then thinking the next step about whether or not they should be screened for fatty liver disease. So the first criteria is excess adiposity. So that can simply be a mildly elevated BMI in non-Asians. That would be greater than 25, which is considered overweight, and in Asians it would be a BMI greater than 23. That is not a very high BMI at all. Or they could have central obesity. So they could have a low BMI, but it's all packed right in the middle. Think of the typical dad bod or the typical apple shape person, right? So the BMI doesn't have to be significantly high. The body habitus can be measured based on waist circumference. Then another criteria aside from adiposity would be having a disorder of glucose metabolism. That could be either prediabetes or overt diabetes, or it could be somebody that's being treated for hyperglycemia with the normal sugar in the normal range, but that they're getting there due to treatment. Another criteria would be hypertriglyceridemia, or another criteria is HDL that is low. And the final criteria would be hypertension or elevated blood pressure, or even normal blood pressure that is being treated. So, these are the five basic criteria that we would use. And if you think about it, that's kind of like most of our patients. So, as a primary care doctor, I am screening a lot of my patients more and more. And as I said before, I am absolutely surprised as to how many people I am finding that have MASLD. Or even MASH based on simple screening. And we'll talk about the screening in the future. And then, in clinical practice, even those patients that I don't think might be at risk for MASLD or MASH, but we find incidental findings on CT scan of the abdomen or ultrasound of the abdomen where a patient, is reported to have excess fatty buildup or heterogeneous liver morphology, those are all things that we need to think about. Then we always send them to Dr. Chasudian for further workup.
Yes, no, I couldn't agree with you more that it is so common in any healthcare setting to see patients with these metabolic features that you just went through, who are clearly at risk for a variety of metabolic associated diseases. And I think we have become very good at looking at blood glucose and hemoglobin A1C and lipids and blood pressure. And perhaps what sometimes gets forgotten or overlooked is the liver disease aspect of this, the mast cell and potential MASH. I think it's important to understand that patients usually have no symptoms from this disease, or at least no specific symptoms. And just as you mentioned, it's something that we have to actively screen for. We do have to look at, say, their liver enzymes, or do they have any imaging of their liver where we might identify some fat that could then cause us to take the next step and really look into the existence of mast cell or MASH and how severe that might be in an individual patient. But we see so many patients with metabolic risk factors, and we should be thinking about the potential for having mast cell or MASH and screening that population in primary care settings, in diabetes practices like your own, endocrinology offices, anywhere where these patients are seeking care. And when we identify that, we can certainly then help that patient by risk stratifying them. And that's some of what we'll talk about over the course of this discussion.
Yeah. I wanted to point out also, primary care physicians typically have a very holistic attitude towards their patients, where they're trying to treat all of their medical conditions that they might be at risk for or might be diagnosed with actively. Sometimes you get patients that are so-called healthy, right? That come in and then they think that everything is fine. And that's like, oh, yeah, I just have a dad bod. It's normal. All my buddies have it. But then when you dig a little bit deeper, you can find some diagnoses that might be so overt to help maybe push the needle and put a seed in the patient's head that, a little bit of lifestyle modification now is can go a very long way towards preventing future disease and not only mast cell and MASH, but further development of hypertension, further development of dyslipidemia, further development of, dysglycemia. I think many PCPs, it will resonate to find any excuse to help begin the lifestyle modification process and at least put that little seed in their brain so that they need to think about it. And it helps a PCP think about, screening their patient population a little bit better too.
Absolutely.
So let's take a look at a case study so that we can maybe really drill this home for a lot of other people. And by the way, this case we're going to start here in the first webinar is going to continue throughout the other four the other three programs that we're doing. So let's go with a hypothetical patient named Mr. B. He's a 61-year-old gentleman that works in the utilities field as a crew chief, and he presents for a routine follow-up visit. He feels well. He has no specific complaints. He denies fatigue, abdominal pain, pruritus, jaundice, so there's no liver complaints. His history is typical for most people with his presentation in the middle age. He has type 2 diabetes. He has dyslipidemia. He has hypertension. He's overweight a little bit, BMI of 29.1. He drinks an occasional glass of wine with dinner, so no excess alcohol intake. His current meds are metformin, valsartan, hydrochlorothiazide. So these are all pretty typical treatment modalities for patients with his conditions. His physical exam is unremarkable, aside from the fact that he's a little bit heavyset. Let's go next to his lipids and his liver function studies. His AST is 28, his ALT is 36, so both in the normal range. Alkaline phosphatase is 100, total bilirubin is 1, albumin is 4. Platelets, 110,000. So all that is pretty routine. LDL is 130, HDL is 36, triglycerides of 235, and hemoglobin A1C of 7.1. So that's not terrible at all. So before we discuss this case further, let's get everybody involved. We're just going to level set a little bit. We haven't gone through the steps for risk stratification yet. So we just want to make sure that we see if everybody is really experts at this or really is here to learn. So what of the following is the first step for risk stratification. And we have five choices here. The first choice could be FIB-4 calculation. Second choice is liver biopsy. The third choice is MR elastography. Fourth choice is ultrasound transient elastography. And the fifth choice is, I don't know. Be honest here. We're all here to learn. This is completely anonymous. We just want to find out what your basic knowledge is and, how great of a job we did for teaching you. So the correct answer is the first choice, the FIB-4 calculation. It's non-invasive, very inexpensive. As long as patients have had routine blood work, then you can calculate a FIB-4. Dr. Jasudian, why don't you tell our audience a little bit more about the screening?
Yes, this is a very widely available score. It's one of the non-invasive tests that can help you estimate the likelihood that your patient with mast cell or MASH has really advanced fibrosis. Advanced fibrosis is a level of scarring of the liver that either is cirrhosis, stage four scarring, or nearing that, stage three or so. Those are patients you'd really want to look into more deeply in terms of their actual level of fibrosis. You would want to consider them for therapy to help arrest the fibrosis that they've progressed or potentially even cause a regression of that fibrosis as you treat their underlying MASH or mast cells. And that's something that we will continue to discuss over the course of these series of discussions. So this, as you can see here, the FIB-4 score involves some basic information, some basic blood tests that are really sent all over the place. It's not a specialized type of test that's only available in certain centers. So it incorporates the patient's age, their liver enzymes, ALT and AST, and their platelet count. Why is the platelet count important? Because as patients develop more advanced fibrosis, certainly cirrhosis, they could be at risk of developing portal hypertension, backup of blood flow that causes enlargement of their spleen, and thrombocytopenia or low platelets. So using that information, a FIB-4 calculator, you could find that online, or some of the electronic medical record systems have this integrated in them. You could then see a score that gives you an assessment of your patient's fibrosis through this non-invasive estimation. Scores less than 1.3 are very reassuring. This rules out advanced fibrosis pretty effectively. Whereas scores greater than 2.67 are relatively predictive of advanced fibrosis. That's certainly someone who you would want to look into more closely in terms of how much fibrosis they actually have. But I think of it as a good initial branch point in someone with mast cell or MASH to tell you how concerned should I be about this person's liver, how much fibrosis they have at this point in time. And again, it's available to you as long as you're sending liver enzymes and you know the patient's age and you can send a CBC and get a platelet count.
Excellent. Thank you very much. I do want to point out one caveat. In my organization, we recently started doing building in mast cell screening with FIB-4s in our EMR. We use Epic as many other clinicians do. To your point, it was quite easy. Even when the score doesn't automatically calculate for whatever reason, you can simply enter dot FIB-4 and then it would come out. But there is a little bit of a caveat because the accuracy diminishes as the patient gets older. And in our organization, over the age of 65, the cutoff for us goes up to 2.0. So we use that just to help maintain the utility of that calculation. Is
That's
that
a good point.
about what you would recommend?
Yes, no, I think that makes good sense. So I'm glad you brought that up.
Excellent. Let's go back to our gentleman, Mr. B. In Mr. B, his calculation comes out at 2.59. So despite all of his transaminases being normal, despite his platelet count being normal, Well, his platelet count was a touch low. 2.59 is a pretty significantly high reading, for somebody who might not overtly have struck us as a liver disease patient. So when this 2.59 comes into play, and then the low risk would be under 1.3, and then the high risk would be greater than 2.7. So he falls in this intermediate category. What do you think the next step should be, Dr. Sousoudian?
Yes, so this is certainly someone I would be concerned about having advanced fibrosis in based off of that FIB4. It's not absolutely above that cutoff of 2.67, but it is a pretty high FIB4. And what I would say about patients like this is that clearly he is at risk for having MASLD or MASH. And he did have, sort of lower platelets. And we shouldn't be falsely reassured by his transaminases, his AST and ALT being normal, because that's often the case. They don't have to be elevated in patients who have MASLD or MASH. And in my line of work, I see a lot of patients with cirrhosis. And what happens with cirrhosis is that as fibrosis develops and progresses, there's more and more scar tissue in the liver, which means there's less and less healthy hepatocytes or liver cells. That's where AST and ALT come from. So patients with cirrhosis oftentimes will have normal liver enzymes because they really don't have as many hepatocytes left over to generate higher than normal transaminase levels. So it's possible that he could have compensated cirrhosis. Compensated cirrhosis is by definition asymptomatic, so patients often don't know that they have it. And this high FIB4 could be a tip-off about that. And some other pieces of information that would be helpful, if he's ever had any imaging of his liver or if you get an ultrasound, it would be helpful to see if he has steatosis in his liver. And certainly, I would pretty much expect this in him because he has metabolic risk factors. He has a high FIB4 score. He, if you take him at his word, is not really drinking in excess. And then we do have some additional non-invasive fibrosis assessments that are more accurate than a FIB4. And you saw them on that question that you answered, some of the options there. So we have transient elastography or an ultrasound-based liver stiffness measurement. Stiffer livers have more scar tissue in them, and that's how elastography or liver stiffness measurement works. There is MRI with elastography. That is a more sophisticated test. It's not as widely available as an ultrasound-based elastography, which is often found in offices or with a small machine that doesn't require a big infrastructure to support it. There are other serum-based tests that are more accurate than a FIB4 send-out tests like the ELF or the Enhanced Liver Fibrosis score. So in general, if you see a high FIB4 and you want to know with more certainty what this gentleman's fibrosis degree is or how concerned you should be about advanced fibrosis or cirrhosis, you could then choose a second non-invasive test. And there's always liver biopsy available, usually reserved for if you might be entertaining two different liver diseases, for example. Maybe you're worried he has like an autoimmune hepatitis based on some antibodies or serologies you sent. That's when a liver biopsy could be helpful. But we can find out a lot about fibrosis assessment through non-invasive testing.
Yeah, I wanted to point out that recently the FDA published new guidelines regarding research trials involving therapeutics, and they recently said that liver biopsies were not required and that non-invasive testing was equivalent. So the accuracy seems to be pretty good at determining fibrosis score without having to, stick a needle in a vascular organ and all the risks that are associated with that. So I think people can rest assured in choosing a non-invasive test and feeling reasonably comforted that it is an accurate approximation of fibrosis.
So I just mentioned a number of different non-invasive tests or fibrosis assessments in terms of introducing them to you, but in the next program, you're going to hear about them in much more detail.
So I wanted to also point out that the FIB-4 calculation is simply a tool. It has been validated based on extensive research studies, and the FIB-4 calculation is used in all of the current clinical trials studying therapeutics as well. One of the recent big trials that was published just a couple of months ago, the ESSENCE trial, enrolled thousands of patients with fibrosis. And they had either F2, F3, or F4 fibrosis. And these patients, all in, the average FIB-4 score was just over 1.3. So, once it meets that threshold for significance, 1.4 or 2.5, doesn't necessarily correlate with the severity of fibrosis. So, as long as they meet that criteria for significance, it's incumbent to go the next step for some sort of non-invasive testing to quantify that fibrosis level.
I think it's such an important point. FIB-4 is a great test in that it's easy and it is widely available. It's not a perfect test. And so we've seen in some of our clinical trials of MASH therapeutics where the criteria for entry involve a biopsy where patients have stage two or three fibrosis, moderate or advanced fibrosis, that some of them have a FIB-4 that's close to 1.3 or lower than you would expect. And so that's just important for us to be aware of. But it's still to this day the best initial sort of triage or risk stratification test in terms of it being so widely available and in terms of it generally being good for being able to tell you as a clinician, who are you worried about having advanced fibrosis in, or who are you less worried about having advanced fibrosis? So in this case, this gentleman ends up getting an abdominal ultrasound that demonstrates, again, as we would expect, hepatic steatosis, so fat in his liver. He doesn't have any focal liver lesions. That's important because patients, particularly who have cirrhosis, stage four fibrosis, but also we think patients who have advanced fibrosis or stage three fibrosis can be at risk of developing liver cancer or hepatocellular carcinoma. So it's important to know that on the ultrasound, you're not seeing any hepatoma or lesion that could make you concerned for liver cancer. And also, you don't see anything else in terms of structural liver problems. His bile ducts aren't dilated. You don't see any evidence of decompensated liver disease like ascites fluid in the abdomen. But this is a very common ultrasound that you might see where the echogenicity of the liver, that's what the radiologist would refer to it as, is increased. And that's what happens when you have abnormal amounts of fat in the liver. So in patients with metabolic risk factors and who get an ultrasound and you see increased echogenicity or fat, that's certainly someone who you want to evaluate further for MASLD or MASH, and a FIB-4 is a good risk stratification type test to send. Fatty livers, if you're looking at an ultrasound of a fatty liver versus one that's normal, what you really see in the liver tissue is that the fatty liver is going to look brighter or whiter. And that is the increased echogenicity. And that's what happens when there's fat inside of the liver as opposed to a normal or, a non-existent amount of fat in a normal liver. So maybe we can transition to speaking a bit about risk stratification in the MASLD patient. And that is regardless of your practice setting, especially early on. And we're going to talk about non-invasive testing in much more detail in the next session, but we want to introduce you to this concept of risk stratification. So if you're in primary care or a non-GI or hepatology type practice, what you really want to do is identify patients at risk. So those patients who have metabolic risk factors, those patients who have steatosis on imaging, and then start to risk stratify them in terms of who might have advanced fibrosis. And just as we've been talking about, the FIB-4 is such a great test for this because it just involves liver enzymes, a platelet count, and patient age. It's easy to calculate, or your electronic medical record might even calculate it for you. That less than 1.3 reassures you that this is a patient who's at lower risk of having advanced fibrosis, but they still need to be periodically reassessed in terms of their mast cell or MASH and whether it could be progressing. So repeating that FIB-4 every 1 to 2 years in diabetes patients or those with two or more metabolic risk factors is important. And you might space that out a bit if it's a patient without diabetes or with fewer than two metabolic risk factors. But if that FIB-4 is high, like in our gentleman, or particularly if it's above 2.67, that's a patient who you really should consider referring to a gastroenterologist or a hepatologist and/or yourself getting another more accurate non-invasive test. We mentioned the types of elastography, ultrasound-based, MRI-based, or sending a proprietary serum test like the Enhanced Liver Fibrosis Score. Again, you're going to hear much about this in the next session, but this is just how a general risk assessment would go. You identify patients at risk, and then you send a FIB-4 to give you an idea of how likely they are to have advanced fibrosis or even cirrhosis. And so I won't go into too much detail beyond that point, but that's the beginnings of a risk stratification for this type of patient.
Well, that's about all the time that we have today. I'd like to thank you, Dr. Jasudian, for your expert perspectives on how risk stratification can be optimized for MASLD and MASH. And I'd also like to thank you, our audience, for participating. Before we close, I'd like to offer two SMART goals, actionable items that are specific, measurable, attainable, relevant. So these timely action items can be applied to the care of your patients in your own practice. First, focus on risk stratification for patients rather than just screening for MASLD and MASH, and increase the number of patients assessed in your practice over the next 3 to 6 months. Then, evaluate ultrasound findings and FIB-4 calculations to identify patients with fibrosis, including those with less obvious risk factors. And again, increase the number of patients assessed in your practice over the next 3 to 6 months. And those patients that really are at higher risk or surprise you and have more fibrosis, definitely refer them to a hepatologist for further management and care. To receive credit for this activity, please complete the evaluation and the post-test. And again, please check out the following three stack activities in the series. Thank you and have a great day.